Chapter 23. If nothing more, Eddie Seng had to respect his captor's efficiency. The volcano looming over what had been dubbed Death Beach continued to rumble and belch ash that fell in a choking black blizzard across the facility. Earthquakes were an almost hourly occurrence, and the sea had turned into a writhing sheet of lead. Yet the overseers never relaxed the pace of work even as they implemented their evacuation plans. The boilers in the separating plant remained lit so that the last precious gram of gold could be extracted before they left. Guards exhorted the workers with clubs and whips to keep toiling up and down the hillside, burdened with baskets of gold-bearing ore. And at night, the slave laborers were locked in the beached cruise ships, dreading the call to start working again in the morning. Out in the bay, the crew of the tugboat had succeeded in ballasting the huge dry dock so that the ship in its hold could be floated free. The rough seas had caused numerous delays in the tricky operation, which explained why the evacuation had gone slower than Eddie had anticipated. He had seen a young turbaned Sikh arguing with the Russian, Savage, and assumed that he was refusing to sacrifice the expensive dry dock when the volcano finally blew. Unloading the ship meant they wouldn't have any incriminating evidence when they sailed away. Like the other ships already littering the beach, the newest vessel brought to Kamchatka was a cruise liner. At around 400 feet, it wasn't large, but she had rakish lines, a classic champagne glass stern, and balconies for nearly all the cabins. In her prime, she would have filled the niche market for only the wealthiest passengers, those willing to pay anything for a chance to visit the Galapagos or explore the Antarctic wastes. Today, she was just another derelict, her once bright hull smeared with the excrement of those poor souls who'd endured the harsh journey to Russia. Hundreds of Chinese immigrants crowded the rail as the cruise ship was left to drift in the bay. Because her engines had been removed and she was unballasted, she rode so high that a thick band of anti-fouling paint could be seen above her waterline. Even the smallest waves made her roll dangerously. Eddie could hear the cries of the people trapped aboard her when a big wave sent the vessel reeling. Fortunately, the tide was coming in, and it drove the ship closer and closer to the beach. With the winds whipping up the frigid bay, Eddie knew that a storm was coming. Hopefully, the vessel would soundly ground herself on shore before it hit. Otherwise, she would drift back to sea. If that happened, he knew the liner would turn broadside to the wind and capsize when the swells hit above 10 feet. She carried no lifeboats. Eddie switched his attention from the drifting cruise ship back to the dry dock. Her massive bow doors had been closed once again, and water jetted from pump outlets along her hull. It would take several hours for her hold to be drained of seawater, and she was light enough for one of the tugs to take her away. The second of the two tugs that brought the dry dock north had been maneuvered into position about 100 yards from the ore processing building. As Eddie had noted earlier, the processing plant had been built on a flat barge that had been towed to the bay. They had used heavy equipment to drag the large structure high above the tide line. Under the watchful eye of armed guards, workers were now clearing debris and rocks that had washed onto the beach behind the plant so the tugboat could haul it back into the sea. Drums of machine oil were standing by to be poured onto the rocky shore to ease the barge's progress back to the water. Paulus, the South African supervisor, had ordered that all the excess mercury be dumped in an area beyond the processing plant. Lakes of shimmering mercury collected in pools that eventually drained into the sea. Already, wave action had claimed hundreds of gallons of the toxic metal. The Chinese laborers given this dangerous job were those who had already been exposed to fatal doses of mercury vapor working in the plant. Most moved like zombies, their brains destroyed by the cumulative effects of mercury poisoning, while others were so afflicted with tremors they could barely stand. If by some miracle they survived the next few days, they would never recover from the exposure. And even if they did, they had received such high doses that generations of their children would suffer unspeakable birth defects. Eddie burned the image of the brain-damaged workers splashing about amid the mercury puddles into his mind. He was so intent that he didn't realize the worker next to him had finished filling his plastic bucket with muddy ore. The young Chinese tried to catch Eddie's attention, but a guard noticed the lapse first. He lashed out with a weighted piece of hose that caught Eddie behind the knee. His leg buckled, but he refused to allow himself to fall. He knew not to even glance at the guard, because such defiance would send the Indonesian into a frenzy that in his condition Eddie didn't know if he could survive. He hoisted the 50-pound bucket onto his shoulder, smearing old abrasions that wouldn't heal in the constant damp. Eddie's roommate from the cruise ship, Tang, had timed his work so the two of them would trudge down the hill together. Of the original 10 men crammed into the cabin when Eddie first arrived, only he and Tang were still alive. "I think they are leaving today," Tang said out of the corner of his mouth, his eyes downcast on the treacherous footing. "I believe you are right, my friend. The dry dock will be empty soon, and it won't take them long to drag the processing plant off the beach. And have you noticed the fishing boats haven't been around for a while?" "How can I not?" Tang replied with a sparkle in his voice. "The only thing worse than ground-up fish paste is 3-day-old ground-up fish paste." They maneuvered around a particularly tricky spot before Tang remarked, "There is also what is happening around the ship the guards use as their dormitory." For the past few days, a double-ended tender had been making trips between the dormitory ship and the tug they were going to use to take away the processing plant. The area around the dorm ship had always been off-limits to the Chinese, but since the transfer had begun, the number of guards had doubled. Most of them were Indonesian, but there were also a handful of hard-looking Europeans who reported to Savage and not the Sikh. Judging by their discipline, Eddie thought they were ex-Special Forces, Russia's elite Spetsnaz. He could also tell that the Russians were as suspicious of the Indonesian guards as they were the laborers. It didn't take a genius to know that they were transporting the gold they had already processed. Judging by how low the 30-foot tender was in the water when she motored out to the tug, Eddie estimated they'd moved 100 tons of bullion. The gold was being stacked in 2 shipping containers lashed to the tug's deck. "What do you think will happen to us?" Tang asked. "I told you what I heard Paulus tell Anton Savage, that they're going to leave us behind. So we die on this forsaken stretch of coast, whether they are here or not." Eddie could tell from the sorrow in Tang's words that the younger man had reached his emotional and psychological limit. Like in any survival situation, keeping a positive attitude was half the battle to stay alive. In the past week, Eddie had seen people endure unbelievable hardships because they would not let it penetrate their souls, while others had died in a few days, almost as if they willed their deaths to come quickly. Eddie knew that if Tang lost hope now, he wouldn't last the day. "Listen to me. We are not going to die here." Tang shot Eddie a wan smile. "Thank you for your strength, but I am afraid your words are empty." "I'm not Chinese," Eddie said, and then corrected himself. "Well, I am Chinese, but I was raised in New York City. I am an American investigating illegal immigrant smuggling. There is a team of people looking for me right now." "Is this true?" Using his best De Niro, Eddie said in English, "You talking to me? You talking to me?" Tang stopped and stared, unable to believe what he'd just heard. "I know this movie," he exclaimed. "You've seen Taxi Driver?" "Yes. We were shown it in school because it was so decadent that it drove one of your people to try to kill the president." Eddie chuckled, imagining some Communist Party official putting a spin on how Hinckley's attempted assassination of Reagan related to a breakdown of our running dog capitalist ways. "You really are an American?" "Yes," Eddie said, "and very soon a ship's going to enter the bay." Tang looked over his shoulder at the smoldering volcano. It was a couple miles up from the beach, but seemed to blot out half the horizon. Ominously, the ash had stopped spewing from the caldera, though it continued to drift over the worksite. "I know," was all Eddie could answer to the unasked question. "Hey, look," Tang pointed out to sea. The pair of fishing trawlers was headed back toward the beach. "Fresh slop tonight, huh?" Eddie watched the squat boats for a moment. Gulls swarmed around their fantails. There was no logical reason for them to return. Savage was abandoning the Chinese in the shadow of an erupting volcano, so why would he bother to feed them? Then he noticed that they were moving faster than normal. White foam boiled around their blunt bows, and the seabirds had to wing hard to keep pace. Their holds were empty, Eddie realized, and he saw, too, that they weren't headed for the jetty, but angling more toward the tugboat in position to pull the processing plant from the beach. Eddie's senses went on high alert, sending a jolt of adrenaline that could make him forget, at least temporarily, his exhaustion and misery. The Russian guards must have felt the same thing. They clutched their weapons a little tighter and instinctively moved to cover positions. "Follow me," Eddie ordered. He and Tang were near the sluice boxes, 20 yards from the separating plant. If his fears were correct, the two of them were much too exposed. He led Tang around the far side of the long metal tables and up the hillside, trying to put as much distance between them and the coming crossfire. "What is happening?" Tang panted. Before he could reply, automatic gunfire rippled from the nearest trawler. The dozen Spetsnaz had already found sufficient cover so they could ignore the incoming rounds and instead concentrated on taking out the Indonesian guards who'd turned their weapons on them. The battle reached a fever pitch in less than 5 seconds. Tracer fire cut the smoggy air like laser beams, and laborers too slow or too disoriented to dive out of the way were cut down indiscriminately. There had to be 50 or more Indonesians, with more joining the fight in an attempt to overwhelm the Russians, but their superior training and better weapons more than even the odds. None had been hit in the ambush, and as the fight became more fixed, they were picking off their foes with near impunity. The timing of the betrayal was nearly flawless. Savage and Jan Paulus were on the cruise ship where the gold had been stored. The Sikh, the likely architect of the double cross, was already on the tug with a few of his guards overseeing the transfer. With the ocean-going towboat securely fastened to the processing barge by inches-thick cables, the vessel's captain couldn't make a run for it. A jet of black smoke erupted from the funnel of the other tug, the one connected to the dry dock, and the black water under her stern turned into a whirlpool as her isopod screws dug in. They were making their escape before the dry dock was completely empty. A swarm of guards came running down the hill past Eddie and Tang. They had been on duty up where workers blasted ore from the hillside with the water cannons. Hidden by a boulder, Eddie waited until one of the guards came too close. In a lightning move, he rammed the heel of his hand into the man's nose. The guard's momentum, more than Eddie's strength, shattered the nose and sent shards of bone into his brain. He was dead before he fell to the muddy ground. Eddie checked to make sure no one had seen his attack and grabbed up the fallen AK-47. With adrenaline still coursing through his veins, he turned to Tang and said, "Payback time." The Oregon found herself in the teeth of the worst storm to hit the Sea of Okhotsk in a quarter century. It was the confluence of two low-pressure areas, ravenous holes in the atmosphere that sucked in great drafts of air from every point on the compass, so the wind shrieked with a banshee's wail and the tops of the waves were ripped clean off. The sky was an oppressive gray curtain that clung to the sea, split occasionally by electric blue forks of lightning. The temperature had dropped to the 40s, so hail fell with the rain that pummeled the freighter in horizontal sheets. The ship would rise up the backs of the tallest waves, driven by her high-tech engines until her bow pointed straight at the roiled clouds. Her bow, cleaving a fat wedge through the crest, was marked with explosions of seafoam that mushroomed as high as her funnel. She stood poised atop the wave for what seemed an eternity, exposed to the worst of the wind, and then her stern would rise as she plummeted down the back of the roller, her engines suddenly silenced because there was no water to force through her jets. In the sheltered lee of the towering wave, the sound of the wind fell away, so an eerie quiet descended on the ship. Down the 11,000-ton ship would drop so that all the bridge crew could see was the surging black of the ocean. The Oregon plowed into the sea so that her bows were buried up to her first set of hatches. The sudden deceleration buckled everyone's legs and made dangling radio cords slap the ceiling. The magneto-hydrodynamic engines screamed as they rammed the ship through the sea, their sheer power able to push aside the water and raise her bow. A waist-high surge of seawater raced across her deck, swamping her derricks and pounding into the superstructure with enough force to shake the entire vessel. The water sloshed over her railings and poured from her scuppers like open fire hydrants. As the last of the water finally drained away, the bow would begin the laborious climb up the next wave, and the cycle would repeat. Two things enabled the Oregon to make any speed in the naked face of such a powerful storm: her remarkable power plants and the sheer will of her master. Cabrillo was strapped into his command seat in the operations center. He wore jeans, a black sweatshirt, and a watch cap. He hadn't shaved since the Oregon plowed into the storm, so his cheeks and jaw were heavily stubbled. His blue eyes were rimmed red with exhaustion and tension, but they hadn't yet lost their predatory sharpness. The senior bridge staff had the watch, which put Eric Stone at the helm. His station's flat-screen displays gave him a panoramic view around the ship so he could anticipate and compensate for the bigger waves. He had such a fine touch on the rudder and throttles that he could coax more speed out of the Oregon than her sophisticated autopilot. Juan watched him work the ship, keeping an eye on the speed indicators above the central display screen. Her speed through the water, speed over the bottom, and drift were all measured using the global positioning system, and only when the big freighter bottomed out in the wave troughs did she lose any momentum. Cabrillo had literally thrown caution to the wind in this mad dash up the Sea of Okhotsk. He was trying to outrace the fast-moving storm. The prize would go to the first to reach the coastline where Eddie Seng's transponder said he was stranded. With the storm tracking northward at 8 knots, the Oregon and her crew had been subjected to 2 full days of constant punishment. Juan didn't want to contemplate the strain the engines were going through, and he'd politely told Max Hanley where he could shove his disapproval. He'd had no choice but to suspend most routine maintenance, and with it too rough to cook, the crew had subsisted on U.S. Army-issue MREs, meals ready to eat, known affectionately as morsels of recycled entrails, and coffee. But the gamble was paying off. The latest meteorological information showed them nearing the storm's leading edge, and already the barometer was rising. To his seasoned eye, the freezing rain seemed to have lost its needle edge, while the swells, still towering, were coming with less frequency. Juan called up their position on the GPS and did some mental calculations. Eddie was 60 miles away, and once they broke free of the storm, he could probably increase speed to 40 knots. That would put the Oregon off the coast in 1.5 hours with the storm barreling in on them less than 6 hours later. If he was right about there being thousands of Chinese laborers being used in a gold mining operation, then the window to rescue them was just too tight. They could pack maybe a few hundred onto the Oregon, 1,000 if they jettisoned the submersibles and the Robinson helicopter, but given the ferocity of the storm, the impending volcanic eruption, and the weakened condition of the people he expected to find, the death toll could be staggering. He had worked with guys in the CIA, mostly senior case officers, who could imagine such loss of life with the indifference of an actuary reading columns of numbers, but he had never developed skin thick enough for that. In truth, he wouldn't let himself lose that much of his own humanity, even if it meant paying for it with nightmares and guilt. "Chairman, I have a contact." Linda Ross spoke without straightening from the radar repeater. "What have you got?" She glanced over at him, her elfin face looking even younger in the glow of the battle lights. "Storm's playing havoc with the returns, but I think it's the sister dry dock to the Mouse. I'm getting 2 hits 40 miles out in close proximity. One's a lot bigger than the other, so I think it's the Suri and a tug. Course and speed? She's headed due south from where Eddie's transponder has been pinging, and she's not making more than 6 knots. She'll pass at least 10 miles to starboard if we don't change course to intercept. Juan called over to Hali Kasim at the comm station. Any change on Eddie's signal? Last sweep was 8 hours ago. He hasn't moved. Again, Juan ran the numbers. It was possible, given the Suri's speed and the amount of ocean she'd covered, that Eddie was aboard her, but his gut was telling him his crewmate and friend was still on the beach. Ignore the Suri. Chairman? You heard me. Ignore her. Juan knew he could leave it at that, and his orders would be followed implicitly, but he felt he had to give them more. Since his conversation with Tori before heading into the storm, he hadn't uttered a sentence with more than 5 words. His concern, even fear, at what they'd find on Kamchatka had sent his thoughts inward. Now that they were getting close, he needed his crew to understand his logic. Once she hits the storm, he said, the tug is going to have to haul that pig against 30-knot winds with the dry dock's hull acting like an enormous sail the entire time. Even if they ballast her down to reduce her profile, they won't make any headway in this slop. There's a good chance they even might be driven northward again. All this will give us enough time to reach Eddie, do whatever the hell we can, and then cut back south and take the Suri on the high seas. Juan saw that everyone on the bridge agreed with his logic, although he could see in their faces they wanted to take the easy prey first. He expected no less from them. Now, he continued, we were burned the last time we shadowed one of Cher Singh's dry docks. They have radar capabilities that probably rival our own, so I want full jamming on her. A complete radar blackout. Linda Ross raised her hand slightly. If they have the kind of sophisticated gear we think they do, they'll have to know they're being jammed. Not if we hit them now, Juan answered. He's right, Hallie added. Their radar is looking into the storm and is picking up so much backscatter from the waves and lightning that they can't see us yet. And if we hit the jammers, they never will. Hit them with everything we've got, Cabrillo ordered. Full spectrum across the board. Radar, radio, satellite uplinks, the works. Mr. Stone, I still want to give them a wide berth. Change course so they don't come within 20 miles of us just to be safe. Aye, aye, the helmsman replied, punching in the course correction on his computer. 30 minutes later, the radar began picking up strong returns from the beach. There were 6 distinct metallic contacts. 5 of them were actually grounded on the coast, while another, presumably a tugboat, held station in deeper water 100 yards from shore. Juan wanted to send up their last aerial drone to photograph the area, but George Adams told him the light radio-controlled plane wouldn't last 10 seconds in the wind. Juan considered his offer to risk a quick scout flight in the Robinson. Having the tactical data about what they were getting into was important. However, the element of surprise was just as crucial. Also, the atmosphere was still heavy with ash that would likely overwhelm the Hello's air filtration system and bring the chopper down. Thanks, but I want to keep you in reserve, Cabrillo spoke into a pin mic headset. Adams was in the Oregon's hangar. Maintain 10-minute alert, but be ready to push it to 5 once we engage. 5-minute alert meant the hatches over the hold were opened and the Robinson had been lifted up to the deck with her engines running and up to temperature. Roger that, Chairman. Senior staff, give me a status report. One by one, his people called in. Murph at the weapons station had lowered the plates covering the Gatling gun and the 40-millimeter autocannon. The deck-mounted gimbal 50s were locked and loaded, and a pair of torpedoes were in the twin tubes with the outer hull doors closed. He also reported all cameras were up and functioning. Hallie was going to run double duty on the communications and radar systems so Linda Ross could accompany the assault team. Max Hanley was grumbling his way up from the engine room where he would take overall command as well as direct the damage control teams. Link and his gun dogs were kitting up in the boat garage and reported Linda had just arrived. Doc Huxley was ready in the medical bay, having co-opted the entire kitchen staff for nursing duty. Juan switched to the ship-wide channel. Attention all hands. This is the chairman. Here's the score. One of our own is on that beach. Each and every one of us has owed our life to Eddie Seng at some point since we started serving together, so his rescue is our top priority. Secondary to that is saving as many of the Chinese immigrants as we can. We don't yet know their number or condition, so our response to them has to remain flexible. Number three is the volcano above the site that's about as stable as the psych ward at Bellevue. That, along with a storm that's barreling down on us like the hammers of hell, means speed is of the essence. We're in and out as quickly as possible. I will not risk the ship or crew if it looks like we're running out of time. I'm not going to give you Henry V at Agincourt or Nelson at the gate. Each of you knows your duty and knows that every other crew member is relying on you. We're facing an unusual situation for us. This contract has gone far beyond what we were hired to do. This is no longer about pirates preying on ships in the Sea of Japan. It is about traffickers smuggling the most precious commodity on Earth, human life. We're here not to line our pockets, but because it is our duty as members of a civilized society to stand up and be counted among those who believe in what is right. All of you have had time to think about this, knowing that this moment was coming. Well, the moment is now, ladies and gentlemen. In less than an hour, we engage an unknown force with the fate of untold lives depending on us. I know you will not let them down. He clicked off the radio and immediately got back on the net. There was humor in his voice this time. Sorry, that did come off a bit like Nelson. Now let's go out there and kick some ass.